The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 3, Continued. Cassette 3, Side 1. So, to our shame, we started building a prison for ourselves. It was a long, dry autumn. Not a drop of rain fell throughout September and the first half of October. In the mornings it was calm, then the wind would rise, grow stronger by the middle of the day, and die away again toward evening. Sometimes this wind blew continuously, a thin, nagging wind which made you more painfully aware than ever of the heart-breaking flatness of the steppe, visible to us even from the scaffolding around the disciplinary barracks. Neither the settlement with the first factory buildings, nor the hamlet where the guards lived, still less the wire fences around the camp, could conceal from us the endlessness, the boundlessness, the perfect flatness, and the hopelessness of that step, broken only by the first line of roughly barked telegraph poles running northeast to Pavlodar. Sometimes the wind freshened, and within an hour it would bring in cold weather from Siberia, forcing us to put on our padded jackets and whipping our faces unmercifully with the coarse sand and small stones which it swept along over the steppe. There's nothing for it. It will be simpler if I repeat the poem that I wrote at this time while I was helping to build the disciplinary barracks. The Mason. Like him of whom the poet sings, a mason I tame the wild stones to make a jail, no city jail. Here naught but fences, huts, and guard towers meets the eye, and in the limpid sky the watchful buzzards sail. None but the wind moves on the step, none to inquire for whom I raised these walls, why dogs, machine guns, wire, are still not jail enough. Trowel in hand, I too work thoughtlessly until the wall is out of true, you'll be the first inside. The major's easy jest adds naught to my fears. Informers have played their role. My record is pocked, like a face marked by black pest. Neat brackets tie me to others bound for the hole. Breaking, trimming, hammer to merry hammer calls. Wall after gloomy wall springs up, walls within walls. While we mix mortar, we smoke and await with delight extra bread, extra slops in our basins tonight. Back on our perch we peer into cells walled with stones, black pits whose depths will muffle tortured comrades' groans. Our jailers, like us, have no link with the world of men, but the endless road and the humming wires overhead. O God, how lost we are, how impotent! Was ever slave more abject, hope more dead? Slaves! Not so much because, frightened by Major Maximenko's threats, we took care to lay the stones crisscross with an honest layer of mortar between them, so that future prisoners would not easily be able to pull that wall down, but because, even though we somewhat underfulfilled our norm, our team of prison builders was issued with supplementary rations, and instead of flinging them in the major's face, we ate them. Our comrade Volodya Gershuny was sitting at that very time in the completed wing of the disciplinary barracks, and Ivan Spassky, for no known offence, but because of some mysterious black mark on his record, was already in the punishment cells. And for many of us the future held a spell in that same disciplinary barracks, in the very cells which we were building with such precision and efficiency. During working hours, when we were nimbly handling stones and mortar, shots suddenly rang out over the steppe. Shortly after, a prison van drove up to the guardhouse, where we were. It was assigned to the guard unit, a genuine prison van such as you see in towns, but they hadn't painted "Drink Soviet Champagne" on its sides for the benefit of the gophers. Four men were bundled out of the van, all of them battered and covered with blood. Two of them stumbled. One was pulled out. Only the first out, Ivan Vorobyov, walked proudly and angrily. They led the runaways past us, right under our feet, under the catwalks we stood on, and turned with them into the already completed right wing of the disciplinary barracks, while we went on laying our stones. Escape! What desperate courage it took. Without civilian clothes, without food, with empty hands, to cross the fence under fire and run into the bare, waterless, endless, open steppe. It wasn't a rational idea. It was an act of defiance, a proud means of suicide, a form of resistance of which only the strongest and boldest among us were capable. But we went on laying our stones and talking it over. This was the second escape attempt in a month. The first had also failed, but that had been rather a silly one. Vasily Bryukhin, named Blyuka, Muchanov, the engineer, and another former Polish officer, had dug a hole, 1 cubic meter in capacity, under the room in which they worked in the engineering shop, settled down in it with a stock of food, and covered themselves over. They naively expected that in the evening the guard would be taken off the working area as usual, and that they would then be able to climb out and leave. But when at knocking off time 3 men were missed, with no breaks in the wire to account for it, guards were left on duty round the clock for days. During this time, people walked about over their heads, and dogs were brought in. But the men in hiding held petrol-soaked wadding by a crack in the floor to throw the dogs off the scent. 3 days and nights they sat there without talking or stirring, with their legs and arms contorted and entwined, 3 of them in a space of 1 cubic meter, until at last they could stand it no longer and came out. Other teams came back into the camp area and told us how Vorobyov's group had tried to escape. They had burst through the fences in a lorry. Another week, we were still laying stones. The layout of the second wing of the disciplinary barracks was now clearly discernible. Here would be the cozy little punishment cells, here the solitary confinement cells, here the box rooms. We had by now erected a huge quantity of stone in a little space, and they kept bringing more and more of it from the quarries. The stone cost nothing. Labor in the quarries or on the site cost nothing. Only the cement was an expense to the state. The week went by, time enough for the 4,000 of Erkibostos to reflect that trying to escape was insanity, that it led nowhere. And, on another equally sunny day, shots rang out again on the steppe. An escape! It was like an epidemic. Again the guard troops' van sped into the camp, bringing 2 of them. The 3rd had been killed on the spot. These 2, Butanov and another, a small, quite young man, were led past us, all bloody, to the completed wing, there to be beaten, stripped, tossed onto the bare floor, and left without food or drink. What are your feelings, slave, as you look upon them, mangled and proud? Surely not a mean satisfaction that it is not you who have been caught, not you who have been beaten up, not you who have been doomed.
"Get on with it! We've got to finish the left wing soon!"
yells Maximenko, our pot-bellied major. And we lay our stones. We shall get extra kasha in the evening. Captain Second Class Burkovsky carries the mortar. Whatever is built, he thinks, is for the good of the motherland. In the evening we were told that Butanov, too, had tried to break out in a lorry. It had been stopped by gunfire. Surely you have understood by now, you slaves, that running away is suicide, that no one will ever succeed in running farther than 1 kilometer, that your lot is to work and to die. Less than 5 days later, no shots were heard, but it was as though the sky were of metal and someone was banging on it with a huge iron bar when the news came. An escape! Another escape! And this time, a successful one. The escape on Sunday, September the 17th, was executed so neatly that the evening inspection went off without trouble. As far as the screws could see, the numbers tallied. It was only on the morning of the 18th that their sums wouldn't work out right, and work line-up was cancelled for a general recount. There were several inspections on the central tract, then inspections by huts, inspections by work teams, then a roll call from filing cards. The dogs couldn't count anything except the money in the till. They arrived at a different answer every time. They still didn't know how many had run away, who exactly, when, where to, and whether on foot or with a vehicle. By now it was Monday evening, but they gave us no dinner. The cooks, too, had been turned out onto the central track to help with the counting. but we didn't mind. We were only too happy. Every successful escape is a great joy to other prisoners. However brutally the guards behave afterward, however harsh discipline becomes, we don't mind a bit. We're only too happy. What do you think of that, you dogs? Some of us have escaped. We look our masters in the eye all the time, secretly thinking, let them not be caught. Let them not be caught. What is more, they didn't lead us out to work, and Monday went by like a second day off. A good thing the lads hadn't legged it on Saturday. They'd taken care not to spoil our Sunday for us. But who were they? Who were they? On Monday evening, the news went round. Georg Gitenno and Kolya Shtanok. We built the prison higher. We had already made the straight arches over the doors, built above the little window spaces, and we were now leaving sockets for the beams. 3 days since they had escaped. 7, 10, 15. Still no news. They had got away. Chapter 4. Why did we stand for it? Among my readers, there is a certain educated Marxist historian. Sitting in his soft armchair and leafing through this book to the passage about how we built the disciplinary barracks, he takes off his glasses, taps the page with something flat, a ruler perhaps, and nods his head repeatedly. Yes, yes, this bit I can believe, but all that stuff about the whiff of revolution, I'll be damned if I do. You could not have a revolution because revolutions take place in accordance with the laws of history. In your case, all that had happened was that a few thousand so-called politicals were picked up. And did what? Deprived of human appearance, of dignity, family, freedom, clothing, food, what did you do? Why didn't you revolt? We were earning our rations, I told you, building a prison. That's fine. Just what you should have been doing. It was for the good of the people. It was the only correct solution. But don't call yourself revolutionaries, my friends. To make a revolution, you must be linked with the one and only progressive class. Yes, but weren't we all workers by then? That is neither here nor there. That is a Philistine quibble. Have you any idea what historical necessity means? I rather think I have. I honestly have. I have an idea that when camps with millions of prisoners exist for 40 years, that's where we can see historical necessity at work. So many millions, for so many years, cannot be explained by Stalin's vagaries or Beria's perfidy, by the naive trustfulness of the ruling party, of which the light of the vanguard doctrine never ceased to shine. But I won't cast this example of historical necessity in my opponent's teeth. He would only smile sweetly and tell me that was not the subject under discussion, that I was straying from the point. He sees that I am at a loss, that I have no clear conception of historical necessity, and explains, those were revolutionaries who rose up and swept Tsarism away with their broom. Very simple. If Tsar Nicky had so much as tried to squeeze his revolutionaries so hard, if he had just tried to pin numbers on them, if he had even tried... You are right. He didn't try. He didn't try, and that's the only reason why they survived to try it when he had gone. But he couldn't try it. He couldn't. Probably also correct. Not that he might not have liked to, but that he couldn't. In the conventional cadet, let alone socialist, interpretation, the whole of Russian history is a succession of tyrannies. The Tatar tyranny, the tyranny of the Moscow princes, 5 centuries of indigenous tyranny on the Oriental model, and of a social order firmly and frankly rooted in slavery. Forget about the assemblies of the land, the village commune, the free Cossacks, the free peasantry of the north. Whether it is Ivan the Terrible, Alexis the Gentle, heavy-handed Peter, or velvety Catherine, all the Tsars right up to the Crimean War knew one thing only, how to crush their subjects like beetles or caterpillars. If a man was sentenced to hard labor and deportation, they pricked on his body the letters SK and chained him to his wheelbarrow. The state bore hard on its subjects. It was unflinchingly firm. mutinies and uprisings were invariably crushed. Only crushed, yes. But the word needs qualification. Not crushed in our modern technical sense. After the war with Napoleon, when our army came back from Europe, the first breath of freedom passed over Russian society. Faint as it was, the Tsar had to reckon with it. The common soldiers, for instance, who took part in the Decembrist rising, was a single one of them strung up? Was a single one shot? And in our day, would a single one of them have been left alive? Neither Pushkin nor Lermontov could be simply put inside for a tenner. Roundabout ways of dealing with them had to be found. Where would you have been in Petersburg on December the 14th? Nicholas I asked Pushkin. Pushkin answered honestly, on the Senate Square. And by way of punishment, he was told to go home. Whereas all of us who have felt on our own hide the workings of a mechanized judicial system, and of course all our friends in public prosecutors' offices, know the proper price for Pushkin's answer, Article 58, Section 2, armed insurrection, or the mildest possible treatment, Article 19, criminal intent, and if not shooting, certainly nothing short of a tenner. Our Pushkins had heavy sentences slapped on them, went to the camps and died. Gumilyev never even got as far as a camp. They settled accounts with him in a cellar. Of all her wars, the Crimea was Russia's luckiest. It brought the emancipation of the peasants and Alexander's reforms, and what is more, the greatest of social forces, public opinion, appeared simultaneously in Russia. On the face of it, the Siberian katorga went on festering and even spread. More transit prisons were brought into operation, prisoners were still transported in droves, courts were always in session. But what is this? The courts were in session, but Vera Sadzulich, whose shot at the chief of police in the capital, was acquitted? 7 attempts were made on the life of Alexander II himself. Karakozovs, Solovyovs, one near Alexandrovsk, one outside Kursk, Kalturin's explosion, Teterka's mine, Grinevitsky. Karakozov, incidentally, had a brother. Brother of the man who tried to shoot the Tsar, measure that by our yardstick. What was his punishment? He was ordered to change his name to Vladimirov. He suffered neither loss of property rights nor restrictions as to his place of residence. Alexander II went around Petersburg with fear in his eyes, but incidentally without a bodyguard. Like a hunted animal, according to Tolstoy, who met the Tsar on the staircase of a private house. What did he do about it? Ruin and banish half Petersburg, as happened after Kirov's murder? You know very well that such a thing could never enter his head. Did he apply the methods of prophylactic mass terror, total terror, as in 1918? Take hostages. The concept didn't exist. Imprison dubious persons. It simply wasn't possible. Execute thousands. They executed 5. Fewer than 300 were convicted by the courts in this period. If just one such attempt had been made on Stalin, how many million lives would it have cost us? The Bolshevik Olminsky writes that in 1891 he was the only political prisoner in the whole Kresty prison. Transferred to Moscow, he was the only one in the Taganka. It was only in the Butyrki, awaiting deportation, that a small party of them was assembled. With every year of education and literary freedom, the invisible but terrible power of public opinion grew, until the Tsars lost their grip on both reins and mane, and Nicholas II could only clutch at crupper and tail. It is true that the inertial undertow of dynastic tradition prevented him from understanding the demands of his age, and that he lacked the courage to act. In the age of airplanes and electricity, he still lacked all social awareness, and thought of Russia as his own rich and richly variegated estate, in which to levy tribute, breed stallions, and raise armies for a bit of a war now and again, with his imperial brother of the House of Hohenzollern. But neither he, nor any of those who governed for him, any longer had the will to fight for their power. They no longer crushed their enemies, they merely squeezed them gently and let them go. They were forever looking over their shoulders and straining their ears. What would public opinion say? They persecuted revolutionaries just sufficiently to broaden their circle of acquaintance in prisons, toughen them, and ring their heads with halos. We now have an accurate yardstick to establish the scale of these phenomena, and we can safely say that the Tsarist government did not persecute revolutionaries, but tenderly nurtured them for its own destruction. The uncertainty, half-heartedness, and feebleness of the Tsarist government are obvious to all who have experienced an infallible judicial system. Let us examine, for instance, some generally known biographical facts about Lenin. In spring 1887, his brother was executed for an attempt on the life of Alexander III. It was incidentally established in the course of investigation that Anna Ulyanova had received a coded telegram from Vilna, "Sister dangerously ill," which meant weapons on the way. Anna was not surprised, although she had no sister in Vilna, and for some reason passed it on to Alexander. She was obviously his accomplice, and in our day she could have been sure of a tenner. But Anna was not even asked to account for it. In the same case, it was established that another Anna, Serdyukova, a schoolteacher at Yekaterinodar, had direct knowledge of the planned attempt on the Tsar and kept silent. What would have happened to her in our time? She would have been shot. And what did they give her? 2 years. Like Karakozov's brother, Lenin was the brother of a would-be regicide. And what happened to him? In the autumn of that very year, Vladimir Ulyanov was admitted to the Imperial University at Kazan, and what is more, to the law faculty. Surprising, isn't it? True, Vladimir Ulyanov was expelled from the university in the same academic year, but this was for organizing a student demonstration against the government. The younger brother of a would-be regicide inciting students to insubordination? What would he have got for that in our day? He would certainly have been shot. And of the rest, some would have got 25 and others 10 years. Whereas he was merely expelled. Such cruelty! Yes, but he was also banished. To Sakhalin? There were, incidentally, political prisoners on Sakhalin, but it happened not a single notable Bolshevik, or for that matter Menshevik, was ever there. No, to the family estate of Kokushkino, where he intended to spend the summer anyway. He wanted to work, so they gave him an opportunity. To fell trees in the frozen north? No, to practice law in Samara, where he was simultaneously active in illegal political circles. After this, he was allowed to take his examinations at St. Petersburg University as an external student. With his curriculum vitae, what was the special section thinking of? Then a few years later, this same young revolutionary was arrested for founding in the capital a League of Struggle for the Liberation of the Working Class, no less. He had repeatedly made seditious speeches to workers, had written political leaflets. Was he tortured, starved? No, they created for him conditions conducive to intellectual work. In the Petersburg Investigation Prison, where he was held for a year, and where he was allowed to receive the dozens of books he needed, he wrote the greater part of The Development of Capitalism in Russia, and moreover forwarded, legally, through the prosecutor's office, his Economic Essays to the Marxist journal Novoye Slovo. While in prison, he followed a prescribed diet, could have dinners sent in at his own expense, buy milk, buy mineral water from a chemist's shop, and receive parcels from home 3 times a week. Trotsky, too, was able to put the first draft of his theory of permanent revolution on paper in the Peter and Paul fortress. But then, of course, he was condemned by a 3-man tribunal and shot. No, he wasn't even jailed, only banished. To Yakutia, then, for life? No, to a land of plenty, Minusinsk, and for 3 years. He was taken there in handcuffs, in a prison train. Not at all. He travelled like a free man, went around Petersburg for 3 days without interference, then did the same in Moscow. He had to leave instructions for clandestine correspondence, establish connections, hold a conference of revolutionaries still at large. He was even allowed to go into exile at his own expense. that is to travel with free passengers. Lenin never sampled a single convict train or a single transit prison on his way out to Siberia or, of course, on the return journey. Then, in Krasnoyarsk, 2 more months' work in the library saw The Development of Capitalism finished, and this book, written by a political exile, appeared in print without obstruction from the censorship. Measure that by our yardstick. But what would he live on in that remote village where he would obviously find no work? He asked for an allowance from the state, and they paid him more than he needed. It would have been impossible to create better conditions than Lenin enjoyed in his one and only period of banishment. A healthy diet at extremely low prices, plenty of meat, a sheep every week, milk, vegetables. He could hunt to his heart's content. When he was dissatisfied with his dog, friends seriously considered sending him one from Petersburg. When mosquitoes bit him while he was out hunting, he ordered kid gloves. He was cured of his gastric disorders and the other illnesses of his youth, and rapidly put on weight. He had no obligations, no work to do, no duties, nor did his womenfolk exert themselves. For 2.5 rubles a month, a 15-year-old peasant girl did all the rough work about the house. Lenin had no need to write for money, turned down offers of paid work from Petersburg, and wrote only things which could bring him literary fame. He served his term of banishment. He could have escaped without difficulty, but was too circumspect for that. Was his sentence automatically extended? Converted to deportation for life? How could it be? That would have been illegal. He was given permission to reside in Pskov, on condition that he did not visit the capital. He did visit Riga and Smolensk. He was not under surveillance. Then he and his friend, Martov, took a basket of forbidden literature to the capital, travelling via Tsarskoye Selo, where there were particularly strict controls. They had been too clever by half. He was picked up in Petersburg. True, he no longer had the basket, but he did have a letter to Plekhanov in invisible ink with the whole plan for launching Iskra. The police, though, could not put themselves to all that trouble. He was under arrest and in a cell for 3 weeks. The letter was in their hands, and it remained undeciphered. What was the result of this unauthorized absence from Pskov? 20 years' hard labor, as it would have been in our time? No, just those 3 weeks under arrest, after which he was freed completely to travel around Russia, setting up distribution centers for Iskra, then abroad to arrange publication. The police see no objection to granting him a passport for foreign travel. But this was the least of it. As an émigré, he would send home to Russia an article on Marx for the Granat Encyclopedia, and it would be printed. Just imagine the Bolshaya Encyclopedia publishing an émigré article on Berdyaev. Nor was it the only one. Finally, he carried on subversive activity from a little town in Austrian Poland near the Russian frontier, but no one sent undercover thugs to abduct him and bring him back alive, though it would have been the easiest thing in the world. Tsardom was always weak and irresolute in pursuit of its enemies. You can trace the same pattern in the story of any important social democrat. Stalin in particular, though here suspicion of other contributory factors insinuates itself. Thus, in 1904, Kamenev's room in Moscow was searched and compromising correspondence was seized. Under interrogation, he refused all explanation, and that was that. He was banished to his parents' place of residence. The SRs, it is true, were persecuted more severely, but how severely? Would you say that Gershuny, arrested in 1903, had no serious crimes to answer for? Or Savinkov, arrested in 1906? They organized the assassination of some of the highest-placed people in the empire, yet they were not executed. Then Maria Spiridonova was allowed to escape. She shot General Luzhinovsky, who put down the peasant rising in Tambov, shot him point-blank, and once again they could not bring themselves to execute a terrorist and only sent her to forced labor. She was released from forced labor by the February Revolution, but then in 1918 she was arrested on a number of occasions by the Cheka. Like other socialists, she was shuffled, redealt, and finally discarded in the great game of patience. She She spent some time in exile in Samarkand, Tashkent, and Ufa. Afterward, her trail is lost in one of the political isolators. Somewhere or other, she was shot. Just imagine what would have happened if a 17-year-old schoolgirl had shot the suppressor of the 1921 Peasant Rising, also in Tambov. How many thousands of high school pupils and intellectuals would have been summarily shot without trial in the wave of retaliatory Red Terror? Were people shot for the naval mutiny at Sveborg? No, just exiled. Ivanov Razumnik recalls how students were punished for the great demonstration in Petersburg in 1901. The scene in the Petersburg prison was like a student picnic, roars of laughter, community singing, students walking around freely from cell to cell. Ivanov Razumnik even had the impertinence to ask the prison governor to let him attend a performance by the touring company of the Moscow Art Theatre, so as not to waste his ticket. Later he was sentenced to banishment to Simferopol, which was his own choice, and he hiked all over the Crimea with a rucksack. Ariadna Tirkova writes about this period as follows. We stuck to our principles, and the prison regime was not strict. Gendarme officers offered them meals from the best restaurant, Dodon's. According to the indefatigably curious Burtsev, the Petersburg prisons were much more humane than those of Western Europe. For calling on the Moscow workers to rise up in arms and overthrow the autocracy, Leonid Andreev was kept in a cell for 15 whole days. He himself thought it was rather little, and added 3 weeks in his own account. Here are some entries in his diary at the time. Solitary confinement. Never mind, it's not so bad. I make my bed, pull up my stool and my lamp, put some cigarettes and a pear nearby. I read, eat my pear, just like home. I feel merry. That's the word, merry. Sir, excuse me, sir, the warder calls to him through the feeding hatch. Several books have arrived, and notes from neighbouring cells. Summing it up, Andreev acknowledged that as far as board and lodging were concerned, he lived better in his cell than he had as a student. At this very time, Gorky was writing Children of the Sun in the Trubetskoy Bastion. The Bolshevik elite published a pretty shameless piece of self-advertisement in the shape of Volume 41 of the Granat Encyclopedia. Prominent personalities of the USSR and the October Revolution, autobiographies and biographies. Read whichever of them you like. You will be astounded to find how lightly, by our standards, they got away with their revolutionary activity. And in particular, what favorable conditions they enjoyed in prison. Take Krasin, for instance. He always remembered imprisonment in the Taganka with great pleasure. After the initial interrogations, the gendarmes left him in peace. Why? And he devoted his involuntary leisure to unremitting toil. He learned German, read almost all the works of Schiller and Goethe in the original, acquainted himself with Schopenhauer and Kant, thoroughly studied Mill's logic and Bunt's psychology, and so on. For his place of exile, Krasin chose Irkutsk, the capital of Siberia, and its most civilized town. This is Radek, in prison in Warsaw in 1906. He was in for half a year, of which he made splendid use, learning Russian, reading Lenin, Plekhanov, and Marx. While in prison, he wrote his first article on the trade union movement, and was terribly proud when he received, in jail, the issue of Kautsky's journal containing his contribution. At the other extreme, Semashko's imprisonment, Moscow 1895, was unusually harsh. After 3 months in jail, he was exiled for 3 years to his native town, Yeletz. The reputation of the terrible Russian Bastille was created in the West by people demoralized by imprisonment, like Parvus, who wrote his highly colored, bombastic, sentimental reminiscences to avenge himself on Tsarism. The same pattern can be traced in the experience of lesser personalities in thousands of individual life stories. I have on hand an encyclopedia, not the most obviously relevant, since it is the literary encyclopedia, and an old edition at that, 1932, complete with errors. Before someone eradicates these errors, I will take the letter K at random. Karpenko Kari. while secretary to the city police in Yeletsavetgrad, provided passports for revolutionaries. Translating as we go into our own language, an official in the passport section supplied an underground organization with passports? Was he hanged for it? No, banished for 5 years to his own farm. In other words, to his country home. He became a writer. Kirillov, VT, took part in the revolutionary movement of the Black Sea sailors. Shot? Hard labor for life? No. 3 years banishment to Ust-Sisolsk. Became a writer. Kasatkin, IM, while in prison, wrote stories which were published in newspapers. In our time, even ex-prisoners cannot get published. Karpov, Yevtiki, after 2 periods of banishment, was put in charge of the Imperial Alexandrinsky Theatre and the Suvorin Theatre. In our time, he would never have obtained permission to reside in the capital, and in any case, the special section would not have taken him on as a prompter. Krizhajnovsky returned from banishment when the Stolypin reaction was at its wildest, and, while remaining a member of the underground Bolshevik Central Committee, took up his profession as an engineer without hindrance. In our time, he would have been lucky to find a job as a mechanic in a machine and tractor station. Although Karlenko hasn't got into the literary encyclopedia, it seems only right to mention him among the K's. In all his years as a revolutionary hothead, he 3 times successfully avoided arrest. This and what follows is taken from his autobiography in the Granite Encyclopedia. And was 6 times arrested, but spent in all only 14 months in prison. In 1907, that year of reaction again, he was accused of agitation among the troops and participation in a military organization, and acquitted by the military district court. In 1915, for evading military service, he was an officer and there was a war on, this future commander-in-chief and murderer of his predecessor in that post was punished by being sent to a front line, but not a punitive, unit. This was how the Tsar's government proposed to damp down the fires of revolution while simultaneously defeating the Germans. And for 15 years it was under the shadow of his unclipped procuratorial wing that the endless lines of those condemned in countless trials shuffled through the courts to receive their bullet in the back of the head. During the Stolypin reaction again, V.A. Staroselsky, governor of Kutaisi, who unhesitatingly supplied revolutionaries with passports and arms, and betrayed the plans of the police and the government forces to them, got away with something like 2 weeks imprisonment. Translate that into our language, if you have imagination enough. During this same reactionary phase, the Bolshevik philosophical and political journal Misl was legally published. And the reactionary Vekhi openly wrote about the obsolete autocracy, the evils of despotism and slavery. Fine, keep it up, we don't mind a bit. The severity of those times was beyond human endurance. V.K. Yanovsky, an art photographer in Yalta, made a sketch showing the shooting of the Ochakov sailors and exhibited it in his shop window, much as if someone nowadays had exhibited episodes from the punitive operation at Novocherkassk in a window on Kuznetsky Most. And what did the Yalta police chief do? Because Livadia was so near, he behaved with particular cruelty. He began by shouting at Yanovsky, and he went on to destroy, not Yanovsky's studio, oh dear no, not the sketch of the shooting, but a copy of the sketch. Some will explain this by Yanovsky's sleight of hand, but let us note that the governor did not order the window to be broken in his presence. Thirdly, a very heavy penalty was inflicted on Yanovsky himself. As long as he continued to reside in Yalta, he must not appear in the street while the imperial family was passing through. Burtsev, in an émigré journal, went so far as to cast aspersions on the private life of the Tsar. When he returned to the motherland, on the flood tide of patriotism in 1914, was he shot? He spent less than a year in prison, with permission to receive books and to carry on his literary pursuits. No one stayed the axe man's hand, and in the end the tree would fall. When Tukhachevsky was repressed, as they call it, not only was his immediate family broken up and imprisoned, it hardly needs to be said that his daughter was expelled from her institute, but his two brothers and their wives, his four sisters and their husbands, were all arrested, while his nephews and nieces were scattered about various orphanages and their surnames changed to Tomashevich, Rostov, etc. His wife was shot in a camp in Kazakhstan. His mother begged for alms on the streets of Astrakhan and died there. I cite this example in sympathy for his innocent relatives. Tukhachevsky himself is becoming the object of a new cult, to which I do not intend to subscribe. What he reaped he had sown when he directed the suppression of the Kronstadt Rising and of the peasant rising in Tambov. Similar stories can be told about the relatives of hundreds of other eminent victims. That is real persecution. The most important special feature of persecution, if you can call it that, in Tsarist times, was perhaps just this, that the revolutionary's relatives never suffered in the least. Natalia Sedova, Trotsky's wife, returned to Russia without hindrance in 1907, when Trotsky was a condemned criminal. Any member of the Ulyanov family, though nearly all of them were arrested at one time or another, could readily obtain permission to go abroad at any moment. When Lenin was on the wanted list for his exhortations to armed uprising, his sister Anna legally and regularly transferred money to his account with the Crédit Lyonnais in Paris. Both Lenin's mother and Krupskaya's mother, as long as they lived, received state pensions for their deceased husbands, one a high-ranking civil servant, the other an army officer, and it would have been unthinkable to make life hard for them. Such were the circumstances in which Tolstoy came to believe that only moral self-improvement was necessary, not political freedom. Of course, no one is in need of freedom if he already has it. We can agree with him that political freedom is not what matters in the end. The goal of human evolution is not freedom for the sake of freedom, nor is it the building of an ideal polity. What matter, of course, are the moral foundations of society. But that is in the long run. What about the beginning? What about the first step? Yasnaya Polyana in those days was an open club for thinkers. But if it had been blockaded, as Akhmatova's apartment was when every visitor was asked for his passport, if Tolstoy had been pressed as hard as we all were in Stalin's time, when three men feared to come together under one roof, even he would have demanded political freedom. At the most dreadful moment of the Stolypin terror, the liberal newspaper Rus was allowed to report, in bold type on its front page, 5 executions. 20 executed at Kherson. Tolstoy broke down and wept, said that he couldn't go on living, that it was impossible to imagine anything more horrible. Then there is the previously mentioned list in Bailyoy. 950 executions in 6 months. Let us take this issue of Bailyoy. Note that it appeared well within the 8-month period of Stolypin's military justice, August 1906 to April 1907, and that the list was compiled from data published by Russian news agencies, much as though the Moscow papers in 1937 had given lists of those shot, which were then collated and republished, with the NKVD tamely turning a blind eye. Secondly, this 8-month period of martial justice, which had no precedent and was not repeated in Tsarist Russia, could not be prolonged because the impotent and docile State Duma would not ratify such measures. Indeed, Stolypin did not venture to submit them to the Duma for discussion. Thirdly, the events during the previous 6 months invoked in justification of military law included the murder of innumerable police officers for political motives, many attacks on officials, and the explosion on Aptekarsky Island. If, it was argued, the state does not put a stop to these terrorist acts, then it will forfeit its right to exist. So Stolypin's ministry, impatient and angry with the jury courts and their leisurely inconsequences, their powerful and uninhibited bar, not a bit like our oblast courts or district tribunals, obedient to a telephone call, snatched at a chance to curb the revolutionaries, and also straightforward bandits, who shot at the windows of passenger trains and killed ordinary citizens for a few rubles, by means of the laconic court-martial. Even so, there were restrictions. A court-martial could be set up only in places in which martial law or a state of emergency had been declared. It convened only when the evidence of crime was fresh, not more than 24 hours after the event, and when a crime had manifestly been committed. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.